Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avlon. The purpose of this podcast is to focus on finding solutions to the problems we face, not just endlessly fixating on the problems themselves. Now, in the wake of Charlie Kirk's assassination, there was yet another uptick online in talk of a second civil war. This is a subject which irritates me to no end, having written my most recent book called Lincoln and the Fight for Peace on the Civil War. On the prospect of reconciliation after civil war. This is not a topic we should throw around lightly. And yet those of us who care deeply about American democracy recognize that we're in a dangerous place right now. And joining us this week to discuss it is Barbara F. Walter. She's a professor at the University of San Diego, California. She's the author of several books, including most notably How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them. It's the second subheader, which gets less attention. That's going to be the focus of our conversation today. Barbara, it's great to talk to you again.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Putting aside the initial reaction to the horror of that assassination, looking at the larger backdrop of what Donald Trump has done in his first 9 months of his second term in power, how dangerous a place do you think American democracy is in right now?
I think American democracy is in a really sad place, actually. It's in a place of democratic decline. It's probably likely in the future, near future, to be in a place of economic decline. And these are things that are not going to turn around anytime soon. If you look at the underlying conditions for political violence, the United States, unfortunately, has all of them right now. Political violence tends to happen in countries with weak and declining democracy, especially democracies that are changing rapidly and moving more and more towards autocracy. We call those anocracies, and that's actually the most dangerous place to be. Full, healthy democracies almost never experience political violence. Hardcore autocracies rarely experience political violence. Most of the violence happens in the middle. And since January 2025 of this year, America's democracy has declined faster than it ever has in its history. And it's declined faster than democracy in any other advanced industrialized democracy in the world. So here we are finding ourselves in this middle ground where violence happens. And then we ask ourselves, what are the other conditions? Well, we have a population that has easy access to arms. We have a president that is in some respects encouraging and certainly not trying to discourage violence. And we have law enforcement that is not as aggressive as it was even 10, 20 years ago about going after violent extremist groups today. So we have almost a sense of impunity. I think the public increasingly they're still a minority, but you're starting to see the public say that violence is justified under certain circumstances, and you're starting to see law enforcement sort of turn a blind eye on some types of violence. So all of these conditions are increasing. And then when you think about what the triggers are, elections tend to be triggers. And we've got the midterm elections coming up next year, and then we have 2028. So I suspect that we're going to see more violence over time rather than less.
Well, That is a cheery assessment from an unfortunately educated perspective. I'm sort of a divine optimist, but I'm in no way, shape, or form a believer in denial. And, 15 years ago, I wrote a book called Wingnuts about what was just then the extremes blurring into the fringes, and had spoken about the rise and fall of militias primarily through the fall prism. To see Christian nationalism become espoused by sitting senators, White House aides, is a very sobering thing, as is the mass pardoning of people who attacked our Capitol on this president's behalf. I want to ask you, because I do want to focus on solutions. You have spoken about the danger that Donald Trump, who likes to invoke emergencies, could in fact, you fear, provoke one. What do you think that looks like? There's the Reichstag fire example from history. I'm a big believer that only Hitler is Hitler, and we do ourselves a disservice when we compare anyone to Nazis. But that principle, divorced from the specifics of that time.
Yeah. I recently wrote an article. I have a Substack newsletter, and it was about Charlie Kirk and why Charlie Kirk was not our Reichstag moment, but why a lot of people thought it was. So Charlie Kirk's murder was really, I think, quite shocking to America, to the media. My email went crazy. My phone went off the hook. Everybody suddenly wanted to know, is this the start of a civil war? Is this the start of something big? And I think Charlie Kirk's murder, we've had assassinations like that over the last few years. Political violence has been increasing here in the United States since at least 2008, pretty consistently. But I do think there was something different about this particular case. And it really had everything to do with how the country reacted to it, not the killing per se. And there were three things that were really different. And then I'll tell you why I don't think this is actually the moment. The first thing that was different is that when something like this happens, when Giffords was shot, when Republican congressmen were shot playing baseball, when the Wisconsin state legislatures were shot, the country came together, and that included our political leadership. So Democrats and Republicans all came together in the immediate aftermath of that and said, we need to unify. We need to condemn this violence. And they did condemn the violence. That didn't happen with Charlie Kirk. Immediately, you had Laura Loomer and Elon Musk and Donald Trump saying, this is a sign of how evil the left is, and we're gonna hit back, and we're gonna hit back hard. So rather than using this as a moment of peace to unify the country, it was used as a battle cry, and that's really disturbing.
Let me pause you there, because it's used as a battle cry for vengeance among people in power or proximity to power.
Right.
I want to clarify that in the immediate aftermath of that shooting, the Democrats uniformly, high-level Democrats uniformly condemned it.
Yes.
Condemned political violence, offered prayers for Charlie Kirk and his family, despite a long history of disagreements. And I'm talking about Barack Obama, Hakeem Jeffries, Kamala Harris, on and on and on. So, internet mobs can't be held accountable. It's really about people in power and people with platforms. And it does need to be said that Democrats were swift and uniform in their obvious and rightful condemnation of political violence.
And that's a really important point to make, that what you're seeing is one party here in the United States using a moment like this to vilify the left and to paint it as evil and to paint it as a real threat to America. And so to get back to the Reichstag analogy, one of the challenges that democratically elected politicians who want to become autocrats have, and Hitler, for example, was democratically elected. He was quite popular in Germany when he came to power. But one of the challenges that these types of politicians have is that they still are operating in a democracy. And so they can slowly and secretly sort of weaken all the democratic institutions. They can eliminate some of the guardrails. They can convince courts to give them immunity. They could, you know, change the constitution. But in the end, power still rests with the people. And so one of the challenges they have is how do they create a situation where they can suddenly grab all power? And that means usually force, so that there's no possibility of uprising anymore. And what you see happening time and time again is that they craft an emergency, and that emergency could be a fake war. Let's say suddenly drug cartels in Mexico are a real threat and the United States needs to send the military into Mexico, and Mexico reacts with force and suddenly we're at war with Mexico. Or it could be that there's protests in a city like Portland, and you use this as an excuse to send in soldiers, and soldiers use excessive force and the protesters react with violence, and suddenly you have an explosive situation there. These types of sort of fake emergencies allow these wannabe dictators to declare a state of emergency, declare martial law, and basically just clamp down on citizens, so that citizens aren't allowed to leave their homes. There's curfews. Soldiers are now patrolling the streets. There's roadblocks. And this effectively ends democracy. So people were saying, okay, is the Charlie Kirk murder, and in particular, the Republican Party's reaction to it, that this is almost a declaration of war by the left. People were worried that would be that type of situation. And I don't think it will be. And it's not playing out that way, really for three reasons. The first is that, it wasn't really an emergency, right? It's hard for most Americans to feel deeply threatened because an outspoken activist on the right was killed. They might be horrified by it. They might desperately wish it never happens again, but they don't feel personally threatened by it. And for people to be willing to give up their rights and freedoms to say, okay, martial law is okay with me, they have to truly believe that their and their family's safety is threatened. And Charlie Kirk's murder didn't do that. So it's going to have to be something bigger than that. Second, the Trump administration isn't ready to declare a state of emergency and to basically take control of the potential hotspots for opposition. Those hotspots for opposition are going to be America's big cities. That's where you have most of the people who disagree with Trump, feel threatened by Trump, and he doesn't have his soldiers in place there. He started to do that in Washington, D.C., in Los Angeles, and he tried to do that in Chicago. But he's not ready for the moment to sort of pull the trigger. And the third reason is that Reichstag moments are likely to be much more effective if they happen closer to elections. If I was a betting person and I would, look a few years into the future, I would say that Trump is very, very heavily focused on 2028. Here's a guy who loves power. He's made it clear that if he came back into the White House, he was not going to leave again. The history of people like Viktor Orban and Vladimir Putin is that once they're elected, they don't leave. That even if the rules say they have to leave, they simply change the rules to ensure that they don't leave, or they craft some sort of crisis. Netanyahu's doing that in the Middle East, even as we speak. So Trump is looking at 2028, and he has to figure out a way. How does he circumvent or avoid the rule that he can't run again. And I think one of the ways he's going to do that is to create what's perceived to be a real crisis in America. And I think it's going to have to do with violence. It's either going to be, some sort of small armed conflict with an external enemy. And you've seen him do a little bit of this with the drug cartels in Mexico, or he's going to try to craft some sort of enemy within this country. And he's going to do it, I think, in early 2028. It's too early right now. There's Americans aren't still truly believe that they live in a democracy. They truly believe that Trump's going to leave office. They think all they have to do is wait a few more years and this ship will right itself. And I think Trump, it's to Trump's benefit to have people continue to believe that. But as we get closer to the November 2028 elections, Trump will be running out of time.
This show is sponsored by Ghostbed. And this show, as you know, is called How to Fix It. And here's the deal. You cannot fix big problems on little sleep. And that's where Ghostbed can help. So Ghostbed is a mattress company built by people with decades of manufacturing experience. Experience does matter. The team launched Ghostbed with one mission, helping people sleep better with mattresses that are comfortable, durable, and fairly priced. Seems like a pretty good mission statement to me. Now, every Ghostbed mattress is made with premium materials and proven cooling technology. Help you regulate your temperature all night. They're also built to last, backed by a 20 to 25 year warranty. That's a quarter of a century, people. And with a 101 night sleep trial, you can make sure it's the right fit for you, risk free. Shipping is fast and free. Most orders arrive within 2 to 5 days, and the value is just undeniable. Ghostbed mattress cost up to 50% less than comparable brands. Right now, during Ghostbed's fall sale, you can get 25% off site-wide for a limited time. Just go to ghostbed.com/fixit and use the promo code FIXIT, all caps, at checkout. That's ghostbed.com/fixit, promo code FIXIT. So upgrade your sleep with Ghostbed, the makers of the coolest beds in the world. Some exclusions apply. See site for details. So, Barbara, I mean, you know, he's 79, and we have a constitution. You think the Constitution can be overridden unilaterally?
Trump's been able to unilaterally override all sorts of things. And you know, the Constitution is in many respects a very vague document. It doesn't talk about all contingencies. It's open to interpretation, right? And who interprets the Constitution? It's the Supreme Court, which has shown that it's willing to interpret it in Trump's favor time and time again. So I don't think Trump sees the Constitution as an impediment in any way. Orban did not see Hungary's Constitution as an impediment. He simply changed it. Netanyahu doesn't see Israel's constitution as an impediment. These guys are bullies and strongmen, and they just push their way through and see if anybody stops them.
So let's talk about how civil wars stop, how to stop them. One of the factors we've seen, and it's true in the profile of Charlie Kirk's shooter, is there's online radicalization. It's not part of a broader movement. There's the division and alienation created by not only political polarization, but by social media. So let's start there, because that's a specific area, where reforms can be, invoked, although we should say that the Republican Congress couldn't even bring itself to pass the Child Online Safety Act. What are the reforms with regard to social media to dial down the incitements?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought this up. So I think the single easiest and quickest solution to the increasing division in this country, to the increasing insecurity and fear and all the things that sort of rile people up and increase the likelihood of violence, could be quickly and easily tamped down by regulating social media, period. And I'm not talking about regulating the content of social media. I'm not talking about restricting First Amendment rights at all. Let people put whatever they want on the internet. I'm talking about regulating the algorithms that disproportionately identify the most incendiary, the most combustive material, and pushing that out to the widest possible audience. And they're doing this strictly for business reasons. They're doing it because it keeps people on their phones. It keeps them engaged. They can collect more data. The longer people are on their phones, they can sell more ads. It's strictly a business model decision. But we now know from multiple different studies and multiple internal experiments that tech companies like Facebook have done, that people's time on social media, and in particular, the algorithms that are pushing them to the political extremes and that are putting them down rabbit holes that are increasingly isolating them from their families, from their friends, from society. All of these things are having a whole host of really negative societal effects. We know this. And yet, unlike almost every industry in the United States, food, drugs, it's completely unregulated, almost completely unregulated. The five biggest tech companies in the world are all American companies, all of them. And yet we literally allow them to do whatever they want, knowing it's harming our children, it's harming our society, it's harming our democracy.
So let's get specific. You know, we've had Frances Haugen, the whistleblower. We've had a number of whistleblowers. And I always like it when people put forward solutions. We've seen some online bills mandating transparency is the lowest common denominator. But what are the specific reforms that you would advocate to help restore some guardrails to its impact on our society?
So I think one of the reasons why this hasn't happened is because most people don't understand how algorithms are designed, and they don't understand that they can be designed quite differently. So that instead of disproportionately favoring the worst information that human beings put out there, we could disproportionately favor the best. And what I'd love to do also later in this discussion is talk about hope. Because hope is good. Unbelievably important. And if we're talking about solutions, human beings have an enormous capacity for hope. And I think hope is one of the solutions. But the way our algorithms are currently being designed, they're pushing out despair. They're not pushing out hope. I am not a computer scientist, so I don't feel comfortable, but I'm going to send your listeners to the best source. It's my gift to them. There is a website that's run by a nonprofit organization called the Center for Humane Technology. And it was founded by Tristan Harris, who was one of the main characters on the Netflix show, Social Dilemma. As a younger man, he was the chief ethicist at Google. Think about that. The chief ethicist. He left, or I think he was fired from Google after he wrote a manifesto outlining all the ways that Google was not being ethical. And Google, instead of actually taking him seriously and implementing his suggestions, sent him on his way. But he started this nonprofit, and it is filled with podcasts and explaining exactly how you would do this. It has everybody from Maria Ressa, who is a journalist in the Philippines, who did this really amazing forensic analysis about how Duterte became president there, by just mastering social media, and I think in particular Facebook. She won the Nobel Peace Prize for that. But it also talks to Asa Raskin, who he was one of the young engineers who invented continuous scroll. These people understand how this works, and Tristan will frequently interview people asking them the exact question that you asked, which is, okay, tell us how this can be done. And first, they very clearly say it can be done. It's not that difficult, and all it really takes is the political will to demand it. And so what's really lacking is not the technological know-how. It's the willingness of our politicians to basically take on big tech. And they're not willing to do that because big tech ingests an enormous amount of money into campaigns. And because the American system is now has allowed big money to go directly into the hands of politicians. Billionaires can give as much money as they want to politicians. Politicians are much more hesitant to take on their big donors.
I think that Tristan Harris does great work, and that's a good resource. And I always appreciate when someone says, that's not my area of expertise, so talk to the experts. But what is your area of expertise is the larger issue of peace building. Healing yeah. after civil wars yeah. is something I've studied and looked at as well, primarily yeah. through historic context. So play it forward as to how we might be able to get out of what you feel to see as a spiral. And a hope is important. Civic strength is important. Citizens strengthening their civic backbone and getting involved is essential. Studies from successful yeah. pro-democracy movements. It's positive, inclusive, patriotic.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I want to talk about structural solutions that can help stop this decline before we get to a real crisis.
Yeah. Well, it's not going to come from the top down. And you already mentioned that, you know, when Joe Biden came to office in 2020, the Democrats controlled all three branches of government. They had majorities there and they were unable to institute any democratic reform. So America's democracy was no stronger after Biden's 4 years than it was prior to that. And of course, things have only gotten worse.
And why do you think that is?
Why have they gotten worse?
Or why weren't they able to get anything done on some of the structural reforms?
It's really simple. They didn't have the votes. Joe Manchin and Sinema, I don't know how she voted, but Joe Manchin certainly didn't vote for any of them. And their margins.
Manchin did put forward an alternative election reform plan, it should be said, in the spirit of fairness.
God, do you know the details of that, John?
I do. I did. I reported on it at CNN. Basically, it was it preserved the filibuster. He felt very strongly okay. the Democrat yeah. desire to overturn the filibuster would be death to the Senate. I don't disagree yeah. with them. But he did put forward a series of reforms that were all, you know, common sense and had some degree of bipartisan support. But I think the key yeah. issue that you're alluding to is you could not get enough bipartisan yeah. support to yeah. pass a filibuster proof majority.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, American democracy is much more vulnerable to Democratic backsliding than almost any other full democracy today.
And why
Denmark's,
is that?
Built into our system are a whole series of shockingly undemocratic features. So the Senate, which, you know, where Wyoming gets the same number of senators as California, and that's written in stone. The Electoral College, where people don't actually directly vote for the president. We vote for this group of people who then we trust will vote our way, but might not. And the reason we have these is really because of our history going back to slavery. You know, these were all compromises that were made to bring the separate states together into a single union. And there was a lot of horse trading that happened. You know, I'll join, but, you know, if I'm an agricultural state, and I see that the northern states are growing and industrializing, I don't want to become a nobody in the future. So they locked in, certain advantages that have only become sort of, more extreme as America has urbanized, as America has become more multiracial and multireligious. So it's our history and the way we came together sort of as many, many different states who weren't necessarily sure that joining the union would be a good thing. And then slavery, of course, being a super divisive issue and the Confederate South wanting to make sure that they would still have significant political power into the future.
This show is sponsored by Cornbread Hemp. Well, if life's gotten a little out of hand and you're trying everything to find some peace of mind, the CBD gummies from Cornbread Hemp are formulated to work with your body, not against it. Like Cornbread Hemp's CBD gummies are made to help you feel better, whether it's stress, discomfort, just need a little R&R. Now, I am not historically a big CBD guy, but these are federally legal, and I stress federally legal, way to unwind that does not involve alcohol. So I'm recommending it to my friends who are trying to drink less because, boy, that does catch up with you as you get older. Cornbread Hemp uses only the best part of the hemp plant, the flower, for the purest and most potent CBD. All products are third-party lab tested and USDA organic to ensure safety and purity. Right now, How to Fix It listeners can save 30% on their first order. Just head over to cornbreadhemp.com/fixit and use code FIXIT, all caps, at checkout. That's cornbreadhemp.com/fixit and use code FIXIT. So let's play it forward then. So we do have certain structural, things that makes us vulnerable, which the founders were trying to create checks and balances and get buy-in to the Constitution in the first place. Let's talk about what we can do, because while there can be constitutional amendments, the fundamental structure is more impervious. What would you do? What would you recommend that citizens start doing and encouraging their elected leaders to do to stop this dangerous democratic backsliding that could lead, in your experience, to a civil war, given the indicators we're showing?
Yeah. So the main point I want to make is that citizens are much more powerful than they think they are. There's over 330 million of us. Think back to your time at school in the schoolyard. You know, everybody's seen bullies operate, and they see what happens when the kids in the schoolyard, dozens of them, just stand up. Bullies tend to wither. We have over 330 million Americans. And if we just in our own separate individual ways, simply just started silently and peacefully resisting, not voluntarily complying when we're told to do something that's illegal. So there's a whole series of things. And then protest is the greatest tool. There is a fabulous book written by Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stefan about the effectiveness of peaceful resistance. And they show that peaceful protest and peaceful forms of resistance, like, strikes and boycotts and all sorts of little things that people can do, are significantly more effective than any form of violence. And that in a majority of the cases, if at least 3% of the population and a broad section of the population, not just, blonde white women like me in their 60s, but a whole gamut of Americans had sustained peaceful resistance, that in the vast majority of cases, the government eventually gives in to their demands or leaves power. So it's real. Protests are really effective, and that can happen, against the federal government, but at the state level, it could also be really, really important. So one of the hopeful places that I'm looking at right now to study this, like what exactly worked. Look at Wisconsin recently. Look at Montana recently. Both of those states put, I think, amendments into their constitution to make it harder. I think in both cases to redistrict, to just make it harder to weaken democratic norms and institutions. So you have state legislatures who are saying, okay, there's nothing we can do at the federal level right now, but we can strengthen our own state constitutions so that no matter who is in power in our state capitals, they can't engage in these sorts of shenanigans. And what's interesting is Montana has a history of being fiercely independent. Even though they have been voting Republican recently, but they don't like people telling them what to do. And Wisconsin has been,
it's a purple state.
Yes, it is very American. And Wisconsin has really been in between. There's very much still a a battle for the majority between the Democrats and the Republicans. And so I think they want to make sure that that competition continues in Wisconsin, and that one party can't lock in control forever. The other place that I'm looking at is the civil rights movement, right? You had, Black Americans really didn't have any rights until the 19, or at least in the South, in the Confederate South, were disenfranchised until the 1960s. So what did it take for them, a heavily discriminated group that had started with no rights, what did it take for them to change the system? And it took sustained, very peaceful, sort of like aggressively peaceful protests to do that. So there are really good examples of what happened, what you can do when you're in a situation where it seems like things, aren't getting better. You start at the local level. You start with your school boards, you start with your state legislatures, and you build from there.
So that's the case for hope, which is that citizens need to feel enough hope to animate their actions, to be determined to defend our democracy. What gives you hope?
Oh man, the American people. I love road trips. Get in your car, drive around the country, take the secondary roads. You're going to eat a zillion hamburgers. but you'll see the innate good of the American people. Like, there is something different about us. Most of us came here from somewhere else. We came with very little. We had to build something. We had to rely on ourselves, but we also had to rely very heavily on our neighbors. There's a friendliness, a kindness, and a generosity of the American people. There's also a fierce, fierce independence and a fierce, appreciation for our freedom. We'd haven't known any, or at least white Americans haven't known anything else but freedom. And I just don't see them rolling over. I think right now, maybe they're either in shock or they just really don't believe that America could turn into a country, that's no longer democratic. But I think at some point something will happen, and that could be a really, really harsh crackdown of peaceful protesters. You know, that's what happened in the civil rights movement. You know, when Americans started seeing on TV images of peaceful protesters being water hosed with fire hoses, and the violence and brutality that law enforcement in the South used against protesters, the American public was galvanized and they got angry, and I think something similar will happen now. So my hope, I absolutely place my money and my hope in the American public. I don't care where you're from and where you live. Americans are not going to take this lying down.
I agree with you. That is a hopeful note. But before we do depart, I want to push one other area, which is that our autocratic adversaries want democracies to fail.
Yes.
They want us to be divided. They want us to be dysfunctional. And while we have the benefit of two oceans, it's clear that our adversaries want to stir up as much division and dysfunction as possible. How do you see that threat and how do you deal with it?
So the irony is that the United States has the most powerful military in the world by a factor of like a lot. I think we're bigger than the next six militaries combined. And yet we have this enormous gaping hole in our security, and that's the internet. So it used to be that, America was kind of untouchable. You really couldn't hurt our society very much. But boy, is it easy today. You know, Putin, starting in 2010, has hired an army of you know, individuals who do nothing but put out disinformation about our democracy, disinformation about every potentially divisive issue in this country. It'll put out extreme content about vaccines, both on the positive side and the negative side. Anything that creates division, they were able to infiltrate or at least influence the outcome of our elections. So they figured that out. And they've done this not just here in the United States, but in all of the Western democracies. You know, we now know that Putin had his hand in influencing the Brexit vote, right? And Brexit will turn out to be a really terrible decision, not just for Great Britain, but for Western Europe and for NATO. So that's the puzzle. We invest all of this money into our military security, and yet we give our enemies absolutely free rein into the minds of our citizens via the internet.
That is the irony. Of course, our adversaries want to use democracy against itself. I would also remind all of us that in 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell, it looked like liberal democracy was triumphant and autocrats have found a way to climb back, which is to say the end of history is not nigh. Mm-hmm. And we do need to double down on what truly makes America great, which is its citizens and our resolute impulse to remain independent and to defend our hard-won democracy. Mm-hmm. Barbara F. Walter, thank you so much for joining us on How to Fix It.
All right, everybody. We are sold out of tickets to all of our shows on the fall tour, except for October 8th in Washington, D.C. I was on a call yesterday planning out what we've got in store for you. It's going to be fun. Obviously, JVL will be there, so there'll be elements of darkness. We're also bringing in Sarah McBride for a conversation with Sarah Longwell that I'm super excited for. Maybe we might get Will Sommer up to talk about some of the crazy shit that's happening on the MAGA ride. I've got some other plans in store for you, so it's not too late. Get your tickets now. Washington, D.C., October 8th. You go to thebulwark.com/events, thebulwark.com/events. I hope to see you all there. It's at the Lincoln Theater. Awesome venue. Appreciate them for hosting us. And so I hope to see you all in Washington, October 8th.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Moto Casino.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.